Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Æthelflæd, The Lady of the Mercians, by Tim Clarkson. Narrated by Hannah Curtis. Publisher's note: this audiobook may refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. 1. Introduction. More than 1,000 years ago, in the year 911, the Lord of the Mercians died. His name was Æthelred. He had ruled the western half of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Mercia, a kingdom whose monarchs had once dominated much of southern Britain. At the time of Lord Æthelred's death, those days of supremacy were long gone, for the eastern half of Mercia now lay in the hands of Viking warlords. So too did the neighbouring kingdoms of East Anglia and Northumbria. This had been the situation for more than 30 years, ever since the coming to Britain of a large Viking host, known as the Great Heathen Army. Neither the cause nor the place of Æthelred's death is known, but his body was taken to the former Roman city of Gloucester, there to be entombed. His passing heralded one of the most remarkable moments in early English history, for his authority passed not to a man, but to a woman. His widow, Æthelflæd, succeeded him as ruler of the Mercians. This was a highly unusual event in a period when kings and mighty lords were normally followed by male successors. Yet despite her gender, Æthelflæd was no stranger to war and politics. Her late father was none other than Alfred the Great, the renowned king of Wessex, who had spent much of his reign fighting Viking invaders. Æthelflæd had lived among warriors during her childhood, and had known the hardships of life in military encampments. In adulthood, as the wife of the Lord of the Mercians, she had played an active role in government alongside her husband. After Æthelred's death, she stepped into his shoes as protector of his people, ruling them as he had done, and leading Mercia's armies to war. It is in this military guise as a warrior queen that she is now most recognisable to modern eyes. Sculptors and other artists often depict her holding a sword and wearing armour. Yet there is more to her story than tales of battles and alliances. She was a capable ruler at home, a founder of towns and cities, and a patron of churches. Her legacy still survives in the western Midlands of England, especially at places that benefited from her patronage. She is often commemorated there as Queen Æthelfleda, using a feminized form of her name that appeared in texts written long after her lifetime. Some of her contemporaries referred to her as a queen, but others did not, and in the Old English language of her people, she was usually known as Merkna Lafdiga, the Lady of the Mercians. Chronological scope. This book is a biography of Æthelflæd and is mainly concerned with the events of her life. She was born towards the end of the 860s and lived for roughly 50 years before dying on 12 June 918. The main body of the book, comprising chapters 3 to 7, is devoted to the period when she was alive. It is preceded by the present chapter, which serves as an introduction, and by chapter 2, in which the origins and early histories of Wessex and Mercia are outlined. Chapter 3 deals with Æthelflæd's childhood, taking the narrative as far as her wedding to Lord Æthelred in the mid-880s. The next 3 chapters cover the years they spent together, carrying the story through the final decade of the 9th century and on into the first decade of the 10th, up to the time of Æthelred's death in 911. In these chapters we see the close cooperation between Mercia and Wessex against the Viking armies who posed a common threat to both. Here we also see the final years of King Alfred's life, and the first decade of the reign of his eldest son, a man known to history as Edward the Elder. Chapters 7 and 8 look at the years of Æthelflæd's widowhood, when, as Lady of the Mercians, she won renown as an effective ruler and war leader. The aftermath of her death in June 918 is examined in the 9th chapter, which looks at the relationship between her brother Edward and her daughter Elfwin, who succeeded her as ruler of Mercia. The final chapter considers Æthelflæd's legacy by assessing her historical significance and by looking at how she is remembered today. In a broader chronological context, Æthelflæd lived during the early medieval period, an era spanning roughly the 5th to 11th centuries AD. In Britain, this is usually defined as starting with the collapse of Roman rule in the early 400s and ending with the Norman invasion of England in 1066. It represents more than half of the Middle Ages, the centuries of medieval European history between classical antiquity and the modern era. In popular usage, the early medieval period is sometimes described as the Dark Ages because it witnessed the demise of classical civilization in the 5th century, when groups of barbarians brought the downfall of the Western Roman Empire. Many historians now avoid the term Dark Ages, regarding it as misleading and overly negative. At worst, it conjures an inaccurate picture of post-Roman Europe as a primitive, brutal place, devoid of the trappings of civilization. Nevertheless, it is undoubtedly more familiar to the wider public than early medieval, and thus retains a certain usefulness. It continues to be used by historians and archaeologists in the titles of their publications, and shows no sign of disappearing in the near future. A more specific term relating to Æthelflæd's era is Late Anglo-Saxon, or Late Saxon, encompassing approximately the mid-9th to the late 11th centuries. It is mainly employed here as a convenient label for archaeological evidence associated with the period. Terminology. As far as we know, Æthelflæd spent her entire life in southern Britain, the part of the island below a line drawn between the great river estuaries of Mersey and Humber. There is no evidence that she ever ventured further north, nor that she ever travelled overseas. Her everyday speech was Old English, the language of the Anglo-Saxons, the ancestral speech of the English language spoken today. In terms of cultural identity, she was therefore an English woman, albeit one living in a time when England, as a political entity, had not yet come into being. She was born in a period when the Anglo-Saxons still lived in separate kingdoms, rather than as a unified people under one monarch. Throughout this book, the term England is used mainly in a geographical sense. As a political term, it had little meaning in Æthelflæd's time, and would be quite misleading if used in that way here. However, the adjective English does not have the same ambiguity. English and Anglo-Saxon are essentially synonymous, and both are used in this book. They describe the early medieval inhabitants of Wessex, Mercia, Northumbria, East Anglia, and other places where the Old English language was a common tongue. Æthelflæd knew that she was a member of the population group described in contemporary Latin texts as Gens Anglorum, the English nation, and in her own language as Anglekin. Indeed, the concept of Englishness as a cultural label shared across political frontiers was already well established before her birth. As an educated person, she would have encountered it in the writings of the Venerable Bede, a Northumbrian monk of the early 700s, who saw the English as a chosen people, like the ancient Israelites. Traditions reported by Bede traced English origins back to the Angles, Saxons, Jutes, and other North Germanic peoples who colonised parts of southern and eastern Britain in the 5th and 6th centuries. Most of the original colonists sprang from the Angles and Saxons, so it was these two groups whose names were eventually brought together in the collective term Anglo-Saxon, itself apparently devised in the 8th century. Æthelflæd's father, Alfred the Great, nurtured a personal vision of English unity, aspiring to the grandiose title King of the Anglo-Saxons. In practice, he exercised little real authority north of the River Thames. He was a scion of the royal dynasty of Wessex, the kingdom of the West Saxons. The heartlands of Wessex comprised the modern counties of Hampshire, Wiltshire, Somerset and Dorset, but in Alfred's time the kingdom had expanded to include other territories along the southern coast. At the height of his reign in the 890s, Wessex encompassed the formerly independent kingdom of the South Saxons, whose name survives in abbreviated form as Sussex. Together with Surrey, Kent, and parts of Essex, the land of the East Saxons. North of the Thames lay the territories originally settled not by Saxons but by Angles, Mercia, East Anglia, and Northumbria, all of which were wholly or partly under Viking occupation during Alfred's reign. The early Anglo-Saxon settlers who arrived from Germany in the 5th century supplanted an indigenous population of Britons, whose own power had steadily been pushed westward. The Britons spoke a Celtic language, ancestral to modern Welsh. Many of them had long resisted the encroachment of the Anglo-Saxons, who referred to them as Whalers, an Old English term from which our modern word Welsh derives. In Ethelfled's time, Whalers could be applied to any group of native Britons, regardless of whether they came from Wales, Cornwall, or the northern realm of Strathclyde. In this book, Welsh is used exclusively to refer to the Britons of Wales. Their compatriots in other areas are referred to simply as Britons. The term British is likewise applied to the Britons alone. It is not used here of the Anglo-Saxons, Scots, or other inhabitants of the island of Britain. Ethelfled herself would have understood this distinction very clearly, as would her contemporaries, in any part of the island not under native British rule. Viking is used in this book as an umbrella label for various groups of Scandinavians who raided and colonised parts of Britain in the Viking Age. This period is generally seen as running from the late 8th to the late 11th centuries. We often picture the stereotypical Viking as a fierce warrior from Norway or Denmark, wielding an axe or sword and sailing the seas in search of plunder. Many of the Scandinavian raiders who harried the coasts of Britain and Ireland probably fitted this image, especially in the early 800s, when the first wave of hit-and-run raids reached its height. By circa 850, however, the raiding bands were coalescing to form larger armies whose leaders sought territory for conquest and settlement. Although the distinctions between Norwegian, Norse, and Danish Vikings were not always clear-cut, contemporary writers believed that Ireland was colonised mainly by Norsemen and that the English lands were colonised mainly by Danes. Modern historians tend to follow this scenario, and it is likewise adopted in this book. The woman whose story unfolds in the following chapters was born into a family whose everyday speech was Old English. Her name was formed in the same language, being a compound of Ethel, noble, and Fled, beauty. It is a fairly typical Anglo-Saxon female name, incorporating two of the most common naming elements. In modern English, it appears with the variant spellings Ethelfled and Ethelfledda, the latter reflecting an attempt to make the name sound more feminine. Ethelfledda is often encountered in Victorian and early 20th century contexts, not only in printed publications, but also in commemorative objects, such as sculpture and signage. Until recently, it was probably the most recognisable form of the name in those parts of the English Midlands, where Ethelfled ruled 1,100 years ago. An imposing railway bridge at Runcorn in Chester, on what was once her northwest frontier, was named in commemoration of Ethelfledda in Victorian times. So too was a public garden created in the 1950s at Wensbury on the outskirts of Birmingham. To a wider public, Ethelfled is now the more familiar spelling, largely because of its use in historical novels, and more recently in a popular television series. Modern historians have been using this form of the name for many years, and it is the one employed in the following chapters. Familiar spellings of other personal names are similarly employed here, sometimes at the expense of consistency. An example is Alfred in preference to Old English Elfred, where the former is so instantly recognisable that hardly anyone bothers to use the latter. The same logic applies to Edward being preferred over Yadward, to Athelstan over Æthelstan, and also to certain modernised Viking names such as Guthrum. Some historians prefer to render Viking names as closely as possible to the original Scandinavian Old Norse forms, while others prefer Anglicised or Gaelicised variants. No particular convention is followed in this book, the sole justification for an inconsistent approach being that the author has used it before. Thus, the Old Norse names Rognvaldr and Sigtryggr are here rendered Ragnall and Sitric, these being Gaelicized spellings found in medieval Irish texts. Conversely, Old Norse Ivar and Ottar are preferred over Gaelic Imar and Ottir. Guthrum, an anglicised form of Old Norse Guthorma, has already been mentioned. Another anglicised spelling is Guthrith, for Guthrotha, here used in preference over the Old Norse name in its Middle Irish form, Gofraid. The English Chronicles. Our most important source of information on Æthelflaed is the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, hereafter also ASC, a year-by-year record of events spanning the entire first millennium and extending into the 12th century. It survives today in 7 manuscripts. The original chronicle was begun in Wessex in the late 9th century during the reign of Alfred the Great. It differs from similar chronicles produced elsewhere in Western Europe by not using Latin for its annals or year entries. Instead, its compilers wrote in their own vernacular tongue, Old English. They created not only a record of their own time, but also of the remote past, drawing on older texts to present a history of the world from the dawn of the Christian era. Newer, contemporary entries were continually added, taking the story onward into the 10th century and beyond, right up to the Norman conquest. Copies were made of the original chronicle from the outset, these being distributed to important monasteries in Wessex and elsewhere. The copies were kept current by successive generations of scribes, probably via official updates issued periodically from the West Saxon royal court. Information sourced locally was also added, so that each copy began to reflect the geographical interests of the monastery in which it was held. In this way, several different versions of ASC came into being, each essentially a duplicate of the original, but diverging in certain aspects. The original itself is lost, so it is from the few surviving copies that we begin our reconstruction of Æthelflaed's story. The oldest survivor is the so-called A-text, also known as the Winchester Chronicle. This was begun at the Old Minster in Winchester, the principal church of the West Saxon royal dynasty. Its first scribe made a full copy of the original chronicle, up to the year entry for 891. Other scribes then carried the sequence of entries on into the 10th century, often giving detailed information about kings and battles. Entries generally become less detailed for the 11th century, but by then the manuscript had been transferred to Canterbury, where it remained until the Reformation. At one time, it was in the possession of Matthew Parker, Archbishop of Canterbury from 1559 to 1575, and for this reason it is sometimes known as the Parker Chronicle. As the oldest surviving manuscript of ASC, it is regarded as the standard version. Most modern editions and translations are based on it, with cross-referencing to other manuscripts where they give variant information. The second oldest manuscript, known as the B-text, was written in the late 10th century. It appears to be a copy of the original chronicle, up to 977, at which point its year entries end. The location of the scribe is unknown, but by circa 1050, the manuscript was at Abingdon Abbey in Oxfordshire. There it provided the basis for another copy known as C. Some time before 1100, the B manuscript was taken to Canterbury Cathedral, where it was amended with additions and corrections, together with information of local Kentish interest. B and C are not identical, for C's scribes included data that is absent from B. More importantly, for our present purpose, both manuscripts contain a sequence of year entries relating specifically to Æthelflaed. These cover the period 902 to 924 and refer not only to Æthelflaed herself, but also to her husband Lord Æthelred, her mother Æolswith, her daughter Elfwin, and her nephew Æthelstan. The entire sequence is known as the Mercian Register, for it has a focus on Mercian rather than on West Saxon affairs. It is examined more closely under the next subheading. Roughly contemporary with manuscript C is the so-called Worcester Chronicle, or D-text, written during the middle decades of the 11th century by scribes who had a particular interest in Northumbria. Although they themselves seem to have been based at Worcester Cathedral, their immediate source appears to have been an older copy of ASC maintained in a Northumbrian church or monastery. This source had received the usual periodic updates from Wessex during the 900s, but had also been supplemented with additional northern material drawn from Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People, published in 731, and from a set of 8th-century Northumbrian annals. It also included an incomplete version of the Mercian Register, with some entries omitted and others duplicated at different years. The arrival of the original Northumbrian manuscript in Worcester may have been due to a close relationship between the ecclesiastical dioceses of Worcester and York in the early 11th century. Manuscripts A to D are the ones most often referenced in this book. A is particularly useful in preserving the oldest known version of ASC, while B, C and D contain the Mercian Register, with its special focus on Æthelflæd. The other manuscripts are less useful for our present purpose and can be described more briefly, beginning with the E-text, sometimes known as the Lord Chronicle. This was written at the monastery of Peterborough in the early 1100s. It has some of the Northumbrian focus of D, but does not contain the Mercian Register. Of all the surviving manuscripts, it is the one with the latest year entries, the final one being for 1154. Also from the early 12th century comes the F manuscript, a bilingual version of ASC, in which each entry in Old English is followed by a Latin translation. It was produced at Canterbury in the period after the Norman conquest, when Old English had fallen out of favour as a language appropriate for official documents. In the new era of Norman rule, the preferred medium of documentation was Latin, hence the use of both languages in F. With the manuscript known as G, we jump forward to the 1500s, when the Dean of Lichfield Cathedral made a copy of ASC from a version written at Winchester 500 years earlier. His Winchester source was itself a copy of the A text, with entries up to circa 1012. Finally, the manuscript designated H is a one-page fragment from a lost 12th century copy of ASC that also probably originated at Winchester. It only has year entries for 1113 and 1114, and thus lies outside the scope of this book. The importance of ASC as a historical record has been recognised for more than 1,000 years. Historians have mined its information from the time of its first appearance in the late 9th century. The first to do so, as far as we know, was the Welsh monk Asser, writer of a contemporary biography of King Alfred. Asser consulted a version of ASC that seems to have ended at the year 887. He was well positioned to comment on the events of Alfred's reign, being himself a close companion of the king at the royal court of Wessex. About 100 years later, a West Saxon nobleman called Æthelwald produced a chronicle of his own. Written in Latin, this was a translation of ASC supplemented with additions by Æthelwald himself. He was an ealdorman, literally ealdorman, a high-ranking royal official with close connections to the ruling dynasty. His work survives in a single manuscript that was badly damaged in a fire in 1731, leaving a 16th-century copy as the only complete version now available. Æthelwald's chronicle is a useful resource for the period covered in this book, and is occasionally cited, even though it contains only a single mention of Æthelflæd. Moving forward to the 12th century, we find ASC's year entries recycled in several English chronicles produced at this time. These were composed in Latin by writers whose special interests coloured their works. One such chronicle, completed at Worcester Cathedral in the early 1140s, was compiled by several writers over a 50-year period. Modern historians usually cite a monk called John as the main author, although some prefer an alternative attribution to Florentius, Florence, who was probably involved at an earlier stage. As Worcester lies in the Western Midlands, it is likely that Florence, John and their colleagues had access to one or more Mercian versions of ASC preserved in the cathedral library. Meanwhile, over in the eastern Midlands, John's contemporary, Henry of Huntingdon, produced another chronicle. Henry probably used a version of ASC held at nearby Peterborough, for his year entries show similarities with the aforementioned Lord Chronicle. Henry and the Worcester monks appear to have had access to other ancient sources that are now lost. Hence their chronicles contain unique information not found in ASC or elsewhere. The same can be said of William of Malmesbury, another 12th century contemporary, who resided at Malmesbury Abbey in Wiltshire. William claimed to have consulted a certain ancient volume which provided information unique to his writings. His most famous work is Gesta Regum Anglorum, Deeds of the English Kings, a history from circa 450 to his own time. It contains stories about Æthelflæd and her family that are not found in other texts and so cannot be authenticated. Modern scholars are understandably wary of taking William's testimony at face value, especially as he does not explain what the ancient volume actually was. However, as a native of the former Kingdom of Wessex, living in a monastery associated with its kings, he may have had access to genuine traditions. This possibility makes his Gesta Regum a valuable source, albeit one that must be approached with care. The Annals of Æthelflæd. Manuscripts B, C and D of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle contain the distinct sequence of year entries known as the Mercian Register. The title was first coined at the end of the late 19th century by Charles Plummer in his magisterial edition of ASC. Plummer also described these entries as the Annals of Æthelflæd because of their special focus on the Lady of the Mercians. No other woman of the Anglo-Saxon period received such sustained interest from a contemporary text. Indeed, only a small number of women appear in the entire corpus of chronicles from early medieval Britain and Ireland, with the majority receiving only a single mention. Æthelflæd is therefore a unique case. Her annals begin in 902, the first being a notice of her mother's death. The next significant event is the repair of Chester's defences in 907, a project usually attributed to Æthelflæd, despite her name not being mentioned. Her name is likewise absent from the entry for 909, which refers to the recovery of the bones of St. Oswald from lands under Danish occupation. Again, the retrieval of these precious relics is thought to have been one of her ventures. She is first mentioned by name in an entry for 910, which reports that she ordered the construction of a borough, a fortress or fortified settlement, at a place called Breamsberig. The location is unknown, but it probably lay in western Mercia, the territory ruled by Æthelflæd and her husband, and after 911, by Æthelflæd alone. Subsequent entries describe her founding other boroughs, many of them being identifiable today as places in the Western Midlands. Her military campaigns against Welsh and Scandinavian enemies are also mentioned, culminating in the capture of a major Danish stronghold at Derby in 917, and the surrender of another at Leicester in the following year. We are then informed of her death on 12 June 918. After her passing, we learn from her annals that her daughter Elfwin became the new ruler of Mercia. Within a few months, Elfwin was toppled from power during a forceful takeover by her uncle, King Edward of Wessex. A penultimate year entry refers to Edward's construction of a borough at Cledmuther, Clwydmouth, on Mercia's northwestern frontier. The sequence finally ends in 924, the year of Edward's death, with the information that his son, Æthelstan, was chosen by the Mercians as their king. All these annals relate to Mercia. They begin with the death of Æthelflæd's mother, a Mercian princess. They end with the elevation of Æthelflæd's nephew to the Mercian kingship. In between, we are told of Æthelflæd herself, or rather of her military activities as fort builder and war leader. Since none of this information appears in the A text of ASC, it must have originated in Mercia, as an alternative narrative to the official version of it.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?